This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. It's going to be a big show, so buckle up. Brett Baer standing by, Josh Krasshauer at the bottom of the hour, and we have a lot of moving parts today. It looks like the president's going to be having a major Gaza meeting about the future of that region. We also know the Egyptians are training a Palestinian security force. All right. Did you want to check with someone on that? Is anybody coordinating anything on that troubled region? And we have a lot to get to, too. Let's get to the big three first.
Number three.
New Yorkers rightfully have concerns around public safety, and I want to empower police officers to respond to serious crime and hire the mental health professionals to respond to mental health calls.
Really? Good luck with that. More concerning, by the way, New York mayor's race. A speech from Mamdani Zohan reveals more disturbing, ridiculous beliefs and speeches on crime that he won't walk back as Andrew Cuomo gets blasted for making taxpayers pay up to $20 million for his defense. Is this really the best we can do in New York City? Curtis Sliwa, Eric Adams, step up.
Number two.
Oh, I think he's going after blue states. It's just part of a larger strategy to create chaos. Let's look at the crime rates in Houston, in Dallas, in Miami. I can give you a whole list of every other city, the majority of which are in red states.
But they're highest in blue. Disorder is in the order of the day in blue cities. And I guess it's perfectly okay in New York and Chicago as they grandstand to make sure that Trump doesn't send in the National Guard. The problem is 66% of the country think crime is a major problem and 81% want to see something done about it.
Number one.
I want to get it stopped because it's a lot of lives that are being lost. Every week, the one that I thought would be the easiest is turning out to be the hardest. That's President Putin and President Zelensky, but I think I'll get it done.
Going nowhere. Gaza talks ramble on and Ukraine and Russia fight on. Time for Trump to rotate out or get Steve Witkoff some help because he's not getting results. And then last night he was Brett Baer's guest. And Brett is a host of Special Report, Fox News' chief political anchor, and his upcoming book, To Rescue the American Spirit, can be pre-ordered now. It's excellent. Teddy Roosevelt and the Birth of a Superpower. Brett, welcome.
Morning.
A little frustrated. Steve Witkoff is doing the Hamas, doing Iran, Russia, Ukraine. It just seems like the whole thing is just spinning its wheels to the point when Iran, they just went ahead and just blew up the nuclear facilities ourselves. But do you think he needs some help in there?
Yeah, I don't know. I talked to him for a while, obviously last night on the show, and then afterwards. He needs a W, you know, and I think that there hasn't been a real W on the board when it comes to diplomacy. They've moved the needle, they say. They've changed the dynamic. But there's no evidence that Putin is suddenly going to this bilateral talk with Zelensky. There's no evidence that either side is going to get to a solution. I mean, the Ukrainians are not giving up Donetsk, where they have a lot of forces. I think there is a frustration, and you wonder how long President Trump, who is all about the W, the win, is going to, you know, continue on this path. They need to change something in both scenarios. Witkoff said that by the end of the year, he's predicting they'll have an end to the Hamas and Israel situation. But again, where is the light at the end of the tunnel?
Here he is talking about, let's first talk about what's happening in Gaza and what's holding up the ceasefire. This is what he told you, cut nine.
Hamas,
100%.
Yes, there's been a deal on the table for the last 6 or 7 weeks that would have released 10 of the hostages out of the 20 who we think are alive.
But what I don't understand, Brett, is I heard Hamas agreed to that. So, and I was looking before the show, before the Fox and Friends, I didn't see any walking back from Hamas, whatever you can say about their communications. You usually know where they stand. And so it doesn't seem like Netanyahu wants to take the deal that was offered 6 or 7 weeks ago. And maybe that's fine. Why? Well, why? Why don't you want to take it? Tell me. because that's what the Hamas evidently said that. Am I right?
You're right. You're right. And, you know, there is always this dance where Hamas says, this is what we're going to do, and then they step back, or Netanyahu says that's totally unacceptable and we're going to keep on launching this attack against Hamas. You know, I said, what is more important, the destruction and elimination of Hamas or getting those hostages out? And it's – he said both, but we haven't seen it. You know, they believe there's 10 still alive and 10 dead.
Oh, really? I thought they had 20 left and they're only getting 10 out. You think 10 – we're down to 10?
Yeah.
Wow.
10 and
okay.
10. Yeah.
So that's where basically out right now. Well, Hamas knows if they get the hostages out, then what's happened, they'll just the IDF will follow through. So if those hostages, they're going to go in anyway. So it looks like the IDF is preparing to go in, and yet there were 350,000 people on the streets of Israel protesting that they're going into there without getting the hostages out. So it's not easy on any side.
No. No, and these are all complex situations and dynamics. It's just that it's the frustrating part is that there is this portrayal of optimism every time you talk about it on both fronts. And I just don't see where that optimism is coming from.
Neither do I. I want you to go to Russia real quick before we move on. And Sergey Lavrov said this earlier this week, Cut 7.
Putin is ready to meet with Zelensky. When the agenda would be ready for a summit. And this agenda is not ready at all.
Really? Well, what are they looking for?
Yeah.
I mean, so I thought the one thing that I thought was agreed on, that they were going to allow an international security force to be on the ground in Ukraine. And Lavrov said, no, we never agreed to that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is the traditional Russian dance. Right. I mean, they go to the edge, then they go back. And, you know, Lavrov in the same sentence said that Zelensky is an illegitimate president. You know, President Trump yesterday called that posturing and BS. But unless you're going to put the pinch on Russia, unless you're going to put the squeeze on them economically, which you can do. And we saw it with the secondary sanctions on India. Immediately, Russia said, let's talk. That's because they were feeling that. And their economy is on the brink. And, you know, I asked about that. Why not drop the hammer if he's going to play this game where he's not going to the table? And they said that that's an option on the table, something they're thinking about.
Here's President Trump, cut two.
I want to see that deal end. It's very, very serious what I have in mind if I have to do it. I'm talking about economic, because we're not going to get into a world war.
So economic leverage or bring the hammer down. You got the Senate bill, which is bipartisan, 85 votes. But I also heard that Ukraine's been so effective blowing up attacking these energy sites, they're actually rationing gas in Russia. Have you heard that?
Yeah. And, you know, there's a real problem in Russia. If you start getting the central banks saying that we are in trouble, which they have been, that means that, you know, the war economy is not going to be self-fulfilling. They're going to have to do something to change the dynamic. And China has been saving them. But if secondary sanctions go on China for buying Russian oil, that's a problem.
All right. I want to talk about crime in D.C. I know you go back and forth to Florida, but have you noticed a difference?
Yeah, I've noticed a difference. I think there is a sense of, you know, stability. I think that there are some residents that really don't like the sight of National Guard troops, you know, out and about. Then there's some who say, you know, we welcome this because it's a sign of safety. You know, I think they had their first murder in 13, 14 days. That's a big difference from what has happened.
So right now, so far, the president's got 54% approval for his actions on crime. 81% of the country think crime's a problem. 66% of the country would like to see something done about it. So the president seems to be on the right side of the American people here, yet every Democratic mayor and governor says things like this. Cut 16.
Oh, I think he's going after blue states, Democratic states, states with Democratic governors, states with Democratic mayors. It's just part of a larger strategy to create chaos. We're making a difference. Why he keeps doing that, I don't know. I think because of our party affiliation. I don't know. I mean, I'll tell you what. He wants to do something useful. Let's look at the crime rates in Houston, in Dallas, in Miami. I can give you a whole list of every other city, the majority of which are in red states.
But the big difference is they actually prosecute crimes in Texas. They actually have a governor taking action in Texas that will use the Texas National Guard if they had to. But I think what Kathy Hochul's forgetting is that she was the one who used the National Guard in the subways. She did a year ago. She goes, people need to have a sense of security in the subways again. And I would love to see, Brett, the people in urban Chicago, these working class areas of Chicago. I want to find out if they feel secure. They feel like crime's down because auto theft's up 79%, misdemeanor theft up 61%, burglaries up 8%. So they say murders are down 50%, but the shootings aren't. So please tell me why you don't want help.
Yeah. And so this is a political conundrum for Democrats. They want to push back on Trump. They want to call him a dictator. They want to call him an authoritarian. But the practical issue is that people in their communities are saying, you know what, we kind of like the security aspect. No matter your politics, you want to keep your family safe. You want to make sure that there's not a shooting down the street. And, you know, it's the hard reality of, you know, keeping streets safe. And I think politically, it's a tough thing for Democrats to walk.
So Mark Penn, as you know, a Democratic strategist, worked for the Clintons. The president has decided to take tough measures to reduce crime, he writes. An early indication from D.C. is that, like the border policy, it's working. So one has to wonder why these issues like the open border and high urban crime problems were allowed to fester rather than to be tackled head on and even obviously exacerbated for a few years, resulting in tens of thousands of deaths. But even more of a mystery is why we allowed over 75,000 people to die of fentanyl in 2023 and 50,000 to die in 2024. So I'll take a step back for a second. This is me now. The president says, it bothers me so much I locked down the border. It bothers me so much I've declared the cartels terror organizations. It bothered me so much we go to the narco, the genesis of the narco movement, which is in Venezuela. I sent two destroyers down there. I decided to put tariffs on China because the precursors are coming from there. He's eased them since. So that's a guy focused on issues that matter.
Yeah, and the American people see that. And there's action and there's movement. It's not just talk. There's actual stuff happening. And that's why his approval rating is the highest it's been in the Associated Press. That's why people are saying the actions that he's taking on those fronts specifically are they're meeting with their approval. So I think it's just a tough thing to fight the other way. And we saw this in the election with immigration. When there was all this, it's not a big deal, it's not a problem, and yet it is a problem for states all across the country, and now it's zero illegal immigrants released month after month, that's a big difference.
So are you gearing up for your book tour, or are you just not, you're going to get through Labor Day first? Are you all set?
I am all set. I'm ready to go. I'm excited about it. You know this process. It's, you know, it's, once you see it and you physically get it, I haven't gotten the hard copy yet, but then it's real. And then I'll have, you know, 2-3 weeks. You know, I'm not like you where you go 5 weeks across the country to like Alaska and every place else. But I'll put a good 2 weeks around many presidential libraries. And I'll put it all on my website, brettbaer.com, where you can see and get book signings and stuff.
To Rescue the American Spirit, Teddy Roosevelt and the Birth of a Superpower. It's really great. And plus, people are in the spirit of loving the country again. So now we're with the 250th birthday looming and so much happened in 1775. It's really a chance to pick it up and understand our history. Brett, good luck tonight.
We'll see you.
All right. On Special Report, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. When we come back, Josh Krasshauer is going to be joining us, and he's going to bring us inside some of the political wranglings we discussed. Also, what's happening in 2028 already? Is Gavin Newsom trolling Trump, working for him personally? We'll talk about it.
Want even more, Brian? Download the podcast at BrianKilmeadShow.com. Every episode, exclusive interviews on demand. More of Kilmeade coming up.
Mint is still $15 a month for premium wireless. And if you haven't made the switch yet, here are 15 reasons why you should. One, it's $15 a month. Two, seriously, it's $15 a month. Three, no big contracts. Four, I use it. Five, my mom uses it. Are you playing me off? That's what's happening, right? Okay, give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Oh, there's a division in the Democratic Party. There's a division in my damn house, and we're still married, and things are good.
We're in a situation now where when they go low, we need to go lower.
DEI is the very foundation of the Christian church.
The Democratic Party is the party of immigrants, the party of working class, the party of women, the party of LGBTQ. Disable everybody.
Just absolutely insane. So they got together, the Democrats did, to try to unify their message. Understand that they lost convincingly in the midterms in every way, and they want to be able to get at least the House back. So to do that, you got to tell people how they're going to get their lives better. All they do is obsess on Trump and obsess on Trump's crackdowns in everything in terms of foreign policy. I mean, if they want to say the prices of things have not come down fast enough, and some things they have and some things they haven't, you could say that. But the big, beautiful bill has passed. The border has been shut down. Iran's been neutralized. He's aggressively attacking the two hotspots that he was handed like a hand grenade. So you have that story, and you also have him cracking down on illegals that are coming here. He's also cracking down on schools and the anti-Semitic behavior. Huge fines and reformations there. But yet the Democrats are still obsessed with him and talking about stuff that just, I think the average American cannot side with them as. For example, there's this DNC member, Ada Bersano. She's a member of the DNC, a vice president of a super PAC. Said this, cut 32.
I'm from California, and just like Florida, we've had a tremendous amount of raids. We're dealing with different circumstances here, but I've said this a lot, but Latinos in California are dealing with this ICE crisis that mirrors, I think we're living worse times than the times of of the pandemic. It is just grueling.
So she's comparing the roundup of illegal immigrants, many of which broke the law, who are criminals, child traffickers, to the pandemic, where millions of people have lost their lives, schools have been shut down, the learning curve has been bent the wrong direction, and lives are forever altered, even whether it's sometimes people's negative reaction to the vaccine. And she says, this current time is worse than that. Clueless.
This is Jimmy Failla, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
This crisis in Gaza is urgent, and my resolution is focused on that humanitarian crisis and makes it clear that it must be addressed as the emergency that it is. Now, I know that there are some who are interested in making changes today. But as we've seen, there's divide in our party on this issue. This is a moment that calls for shared dialogue. It calls for shared advocacy. And that's why I've decided today, at this moment, listening to the testimony and listening to people in our party, to withdraw my amendment and resolution to allow us to move forward in a conversation on this as a party.
What a mess. This guy Ken Martin is awful. The whole party have decided to televise their family dispute where they can't agree in their own party about the direction of their party. So they decided to take one of the most contentious issues in the world, what's going on in Gaza, and pass a resolution. They had all different visions. Some had more pro-Israel. Some were more backing towards denying Israel arms. So they decided to pass a resolution, and then he withdrew it. Please tell me why they had this meeting. They could not be more divided. The only thing they agree on, that Donald Trump is the worst person who, to ever walk the earth. Josh Krashauer joins us now. Josh, is Minneapolis a success so far?
No, it highlights, you just laid it out there, Brian, it highlights the really major divides within the Democratic Party between a left wing that is feeling more and more like they've got the wind at their back, and an establishment, which is not all that moderate, but is looking weak and unable to stand up for any principles at all. I mean, it really is even worse than kind of the headline suggests, which is, you know, they actually voted on these resolutions on a somewhat more centrist Israel resolution, and then a very anti-Israel resolution that called for an arms embargo against our close ally. The arms embargo measure failed. But because he was cowed by these loud protesters and activists within the DNC, he decided to withdraw the measure he supported that passed. So he's basically extending the drama for an extended amount of time, basically continuing this fight within the party instead of pocketing the win. Like, the Democrats don't seem to know how to win, or even kind of having a playbook on how to win elections. To win elections, you got to win moderates. You got to win mainstream voters. And based on the proceedings in Minneapolis at the DNC annual meeting, looks like they're catering to the left wing of the party and the activists within.
And so, Josh, I want you to hear this. You know, crime, the president's got some strong numbers on crime. Overall, 54% approval on it. 66% of the country says they want something done about it. 80% feel as though crime is an issue. And yet, every time the president brings up going to Chicago or New York, they say the president's playing politics. They try to get John Kasich to do that. He's very anti-Trump, former governor of Ohio and congressman. He said, listen to this exchange, cut 18.
So I wonder how you see this and what the options are for governors in this case.
Well, I mean, I have to tell you, I have such a different take than what we've just heard. They talk about a manufactured crisis. Have you been in Chicago? Have you been in Baltimore? Look, my daughter went to school in Chicago. I remember the day she graduated, there were shootings and killings right outside of her building. And in Baltimore, I have friends that go down to Johns Hopkins, get treated for medical conditions. I mean, they're nervous about ever going there. There are parts of Baltimore that he tells me he wouldn't go into. And this is not some right-wing person. This is somebody who wants to be able to go into some of our great cities and be able to be safe. What's been happening in Chicago has been terrible. I think we need to know what the mission is. I think we need to know what the authority is. I think we need to know what the length is. But the idea that these cities are somehow fine, oh, I think you're
just
whistling.
I don't think anybody, I
heard the word manufacturing crisis. This is a manufactured crisis. No, it's not. It is a crisis.
I've never heard Kasich that emphatic and to buck that panel like he did.
That is an illustration, Brian, of the mainstream, the American mainstream. And John Kasich, he was been a Trump critic and ran against Trump in the presidential primaries, but he's always been someone who speaks his mind and reflects sort of the kind of the average guy zeitgeist. And that is what most Americans think. You see it in the polls. Talk to anyone who lives in the cities that were mentioned. Chicago. I mean, look, Chicago is another great example where another notable clip on another liberal network. Brandon Johnson, the Chicago mayor with a 6% job approval rating, went on MSNBC to talk about opposing Trump and why he doesn't want National Guard in his city. And then when he was asked whether he actually just wants regular policemen, more police to actually reduce the crime in Chicago, he avoided the question. He dodged it and basically underscored why he's so unpopular in the first place.
I'm glad you brought that up, Josh. Just to show you that Josh is not exaggerating, listen to this. I won't play all of it. Cut 13.
Do you believe that the streets of Chicago would be safer if there were more uniformed police officers on the streets of Chicago?
I believe the city of Chicago and cities across America would be safer if we actually had, you know, affordable housing. Look,
okay,
I'm not saying
not,
that we don't.
That's not the question I asked.
I don't believe that we should narrow it down to just police officers, is what I'm saying.
So it went back and forth for about 5 minutes. He would not, he does not think cops do anything. He would defund the police. That's why he's got 26% approval rating. I saw one poll where he had 6% approval rating. But he does not want cops. They don't like cops.
Yeah, I mean, look, Brandon Johnson, I mean, the optics of having Governor Pritzker standing in front of Mayor Johnson at that conference to respond to Trump is probably the worst possible way to respond to the president on this issue if you're a Democrat and you have any kind of national ambitions, as J.B. Pritzker does. Brandon Johnson is anti-cop. He actually is I remember he actually was fighting with Democratic Party organizers when the convention came to Chicago because he was trying to prevent security from and security measures and security cameras and technology from being used to help decrease crime in the city, which was out of control at that point. This is the uncomfortable reality I think a lot of Democrats are confronting, which is, yes, there are a lot of mainstream, moderate-minded elected officials that, of course, want more cops, want to reduce crime. They actually want tougher penalties for criminals. But then there is this leftist vanguard. We see this in Washington, D.C., by the way, the city council. The mayor, I think, is fairly moderate. But the city council was trying to reduce penalties for carjacking not that long ago, was actually trying to pass legislation reducing penalties for violent crime. It sounds crazy, but it was reality. And even Joe Biden had to stand up against it. But that's what's happening in a lot of these cities, that there's a progressive majority. You might see it in New York next with Mamdani if he gets elected. But you got these Brandon Johnsons, Mamdanis, Karen Bass, another example in Los Angeles. They're not moderates. These are very progressive left-wing types who actually don't want more law enforcement. They don't want regular police in the streets to reduce crime. And that's part of the problem. That's why Democrats have gotten in such a hole politically to begin with.
I hear you, because if you talk about crime, auto theft is up 80% in Chicago, misdemeanor theft up 61%. They say burglary up 8%. So murders are down, but they're still the highest in the country. What are you talking? This guy is actually sitting up there proud to say that that he's standing up against Trump's help, which is bizarre. It's almost as if a trap, and Trump's got to be just rolling his eyes saying, I'd like to help this guy, but he's giving me more ammo. He's got 54% approval, as I mentioned before, on crime. So they listen to this Minneapolis story, and they're hearing all these insults and the expletives about Trump. And Dan Torrentine, a Democratic strategist, felt frustrated. Maybe like Democrats listening to this stuff feel the same way.
It's the definition of insanity. You just keep doing the same thing over and over again. And as a Democrat, it's maddening that we're still not serious. Like you said it, we haven't lost 4.5 million voters, nor is our brand at a historic low, because we don't fight hard enough. It's because we remain completely culturally disconnected, and we have absolutely no agenda. You said earlier in your monologue, Trump's trying to solve problems. We always offer the three P's. The personal attacks, which you just heard, he's a dictator and authoritative. We argue process. Oh, he shouldn't do this. He's violating customs and norms. Or it's the press, right? It's their job to do it. And then on the cultural issues, we literally have think tanks putting memos out that, you know, these are the words you're not supposed to say. You add it all up, and we're not in good shape.
Can they get out of New York, Los Angeles, and D.C. and just talk to people?
Yeah. One other example, Brian, since we talked about the DNC meeting, one of the big debating points that they had and one of the presentations made at the DNC meeting was the party shouldn't use the word law and order. That is too uncomfortable for the progressive base. They need to be saying serious about safety. That's the language. So they are policing language about being tough on crime, about being for law and order. That was something that was the first day of the DNC meeting, and at a time when party leaders are desperate for the party to, because I think there is a political space to oppose National Guard, oppose military, oppose National Guard troops in the cities, to do it with police, to actually have a partnership with these cities and law enforcement. That's a good argument for Democrats. But the problem is they can't even say the words law and order. That gets them in trouble with their base. So they're it's not just rhetoric. But when you're getting yourself in a corner like that, it also means your policies are out of step with a lot of Americans.
Absolutely, Josh. I find it really disconcerting. And lastly, this mayor's race in New York City, Hakeem Jeffries met again behind closed doors with black church leaders in New York. No endorsement. Senator Schumer, no endorsement. Dan Goldman, no endorsement. Senator Gillibrand, no endorsement. How problematic? I know as someone looking at it, if you're a Democrat, you cannot be pleased with the rise of the far left and the socialists. But what is going on internally between the leadership and these left-wing mayors?
Well, I mean, what you're seeing is sort of a crisis in confidence between with Jeffries, Schumer, all the party leaders that have not endorsed Mamdani, but are also too scared to endorse, Andrew Cuomo or Eric. I mean, Cuomo seems the most viable challenger right now as an independent, and he's right. But no one wants to actually take that next step. They're not willing to endorse Mamdani because they know his socialist policies are going to be toxic to them, especially if he gets elected. They know that he's going to be a drag on the party in the run-up to the midterms next year, but they don't want to actually take the bold step of actually endorsing another Democrat who is more, for all of his baggage, he is a more moderate Democrat in Andrew Cuomo. So, there is a lack of real leadership in the Democratic Party where, Mamdani's winning, but he's only winning with about 40, low 40s in the polls, and no one in the party has really gotten behind him since that initial nomination, since he won the Democratic nomination. That's a sign of a very weak candidate, yet no one's organizing, no one's stepping up to the plate to actually organize and get behind a leading alternative, and it shows how scared the party is of their own base.
I tell you, Josh, I hate to correct you, but there are people getting behind Mamdani. The great Bill de Blasio, the worst mayor ever. Cut 26.
Voters in the Democratic Party, New York City well. Democrats, you got conservative ones, you got liberal ones, everyone in between. They voted overwhelmingly for him because they believed he was actually speaking to their reality. New York City is not affordable enough. And here's a guy who said, I'm going to do something about it. And when New Yorkers, for example, hear free buses, which is a solution that's being used all around the United States right now, they think, okay, that actually would make my life better. That's like a kitchen table issue. By the way, if Democrats talked the way Zohran Mamdani does about everyday affordability and the cost of living, if they focused like he did, Democrats would be winning all over the country. Right.
Yeah, affordability is a great line, especially with housing. It's a great line. How you going to attack it is the problem. Vilifying billionaires, saying we're going to up your taxes in the second highest tax state in the country. That, to me, is not an answer.
Yeah. Well, I kind of love how Democrats think that affordability is all of a sudden like a new issue, which, it's essentially the same as inflation and the economy. I mean, it's literally, another word for rising inflation, which Republicans had run on, in the last election and to great success. But the economy is always a top issue. It should be a top issue. Just because they're calling it affordability doesn't change the primacy of economic issues and the fact that the economy isn't in great shape in New York City. I mean, I think the challenge that is laid out with those de Blasio comments is, rhetorically, Mamdani sounds good, and maybe he's winning over some people who aren't really fluent in the consequences of some of the policies he's proposing. He's going to have a year in office if he's elected before the next before the real elections, the midterm elections in 2026. So there are a lot of if he does implement some of the policies economically he's talking about, a lot of New York leaders, including many Democrats, are worried about the economic consequences in the city, and that it would actually really hurt the party because the results would be shown before November rolls around. So I think rhetoric is one thing, the actual substance is the other, and that one of the reasons you're seeing Democrats wary about getting behind Mamdani is they know that a lot of these policies, if implemented, would cause damage economic damage to the city, and they don't want to be associated with that.
And Josh, we should point out too that the president announced yesterday that they're going to, when Congress returns, the Republicans are working on a comprehensive crime package. So they're leaning in. If people have a problem now, they're going to have a huge problem when Congress gets back. I don't know how feasible it is, practical it is to use National Guard everywhere, but I love the idea of focus. Josh Krasher, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
All right, when we come back, I'll take your calls, 1-866-408-7669. Don't move.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade.
I'm Janice Dean. Join me every Sunday as I focus on stories of hope and people who are truly rays of sunshine in their community and across the world.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Well, Mr. President, first of all, everyone's made this comment already and needs to be echoed again. You were elected as the president of working Americans, and that's why this Labor Day is so meaningful. For me personally, this is the most meaningful Labor Day of my life as someone with four jobs. And so... But on the point of, you made it very clear from the outset, even in foreign policy, everything we did has to be pro-American. It has to make America stronger or safer or more prosperous.
So that was a good line that Marco Rubio had. But I want you to hear what Trump said afterwards. Cut 42.
Marco has been, really, I think you're born for this job. I don't think you should ever run for another office. I don't think you should, really. You're so good at this. He is so good. And everybody likes him, you know, everybody likes him. But everybody, much more importantly than like, I think you would say, is respect. They respect Marco. They respect all the people around the table.
So, I mean, that's just good at the relationship. I can't explain it. Everyone says it, the way he and the president get along, and they didn't know each other. They went at each other brutally a long time ago. Not that it was that unusual, but they went out brutally and personally. And then Marco was used in a key situations in Central and South America. He was basically giving carte blanche, working with Bolton and others, Pompeo. And he knows so much about immigration. He got burnt on it before, trying to do comprehensive immigration without saving the border. But he was in that, I think, the Gang of Eight or whatever it was. But he also knows a lot about what's happening in Europe and China and knows the dangers. The one thing I'm dead set against the president on, I don't understand why he wants to let in 600,000 Chinese students. They say, well, they need them for the college system. They pay full freight. I don't think we need them. So if we lose a few colleges that are not sustainable because they got to pack them with Chinese, who cares? They're all spies. They have to be. They leave their families at home. They got to be able to produce what's happening at the studies at Harvard and Yale and UCLA. And they all get into these schools. How do we even know? Not that they're bad students. How do we even know what their grades are? We got to get rid of the Chinese. I don't understand why the president wants to go 600,000 Chinese. But and his explanation I don't love either. But I love the crackdown on the colleges. I love when he said to Linda McMahon yesterday, I want 500 million from Harvard.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here. Thanks so much for listening. John Taffer's coming up at the bottom of the hour. I want him to weigh in on this little controversy we have. What's going on right now with the number one story that I don't know. Are we really doing this, Cracker Barrel? So I'm going to talk to him about that because he understands the business model and the huge marketing mistake that people will be talking about, just like they did New Coke. When they rolled out a New Coke, it fell, it bombed, but it gave more interest in the old Coke. And maybe this in the big picture will be a boon for Cracker Barrel. Arthur Brooks is going to be here, Harvard professor, Atlantic columnist, host of Office Hours podcast, best-selling author, and his new book is called The Happiness Files. He teaches a course about happiness. He thinks he's got it down. It's called Insights on Work and Life. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
New Yorkers rightfully have concerns around public safety, and I want to empower police officers to respond to serious crime and hire the mental health professionals to respond to mental health calls.
Unbelievable. Zohran Mamdani, more concerning by the day. New York mayor's race. A speech from Mamdani reveals more disturbing, ridiculous beliefs when it comes to crime. And he's not walking it back. Andrew Cuomo gets blasted for making taxpayers shell out $20 million for his defense. Is this really the best you can do in New York City?
Number two.
Oh, I think he's going after blue states. It's just part of a larger strategy to create chaos. Let's look at the crime rates in Houston, in Dallas, in Miami. I can give you a whole list of every other city, the majority of which are in red states.
And by the way, it's bad by you, Governor Kathy Hochul, who used the National Guard in the subways but doesn't want to be using them on the streets. Disorder is the order of the day in blue cities as New York and Chicago grandstand to make sure Trump doesn't send in the National Guard. But are they really sticking up for their own citizens?
Number one.
I want to get it stopped because it's a lot of lives that are being lost. Every week, the one that I thought would be the easiest is turning out to be the hardest. That's President Putin and President Zelensky, but I think I'll get it done.
Maybe. Going nowhere. Gaza talks ramble on and Ukraine and Russia fight on. Time for Trump's negotiator Steve Witkoff to get some help. This is not a one-man job. And we'll talk about that. Also, when it comes to crime, I believe that the president just nailed another issue. And that is why Republicans have announced yesterday that when they get back to work in Washington, they're going to work on a major crime bill. 54% of the country approve of President Trump on crime. 81% believe that crime is a problem in the U.S. 61% want some action done on it. Yet every Democrat pushing back and hyping numbers that show crime's going in the right direction. But it's not. When you're number one for murders and you cut back on those numbers, but you're still number one for murders, there's no reason to celebrate and not ask for help. Auto theft up in Chicago up 80%. Misdemeanor theft up 61%. 50% murders are down. Congratulations. Burglaries up 8%. And felony theft is up 46%. It's hellacious in the working class urban areas of Chicago. So I don't know what these people are talking about. Mark Penn writes, and he's a Democratic strategist, the president has decided to talk tough on take measures to reduce crime. And early indications from D.C. is that it's working. It's working at the border. High urban crime problems were allowed to fester under the previous administration. This administration is taking it on, including fentanyl. And I'll just give you this. Even if you don't vote for Trump, he says fentanyl is a problem. He sends destroyers off the coast of Venezuela, where a lot of this stuff is trafficked. He declares cartels terrorist organizations because that's who makes the fentanyl and the illegal drugs that flood our borders. He shuts down our border just like he promised immediately. And he's policing the streets, bulked up the ICE numbers to make sure the illegal criminals are out of here. That's what he's doing. And Democrats are hung up on just fighting him wherever he, whatever he does. And people really don't get it. I mean, you could say, listen, I don't like the president's method for fighting crime, but to think it nothing needs to be done is crazy. Here's Jeanine Pirro yesterday talking about what has already happened with cleaning up the Capitol, with more FBI, more Border Patrol there, and also more National Guard. Cut 14.
This is what the president is talking about. This is part of our cleaning up the district and the nation's capital. And although it didn't happen in one night, these arrests, all 12 of them, and the seizure of all these weapons indicate the seriousness of crime that is occurring in our community. And we need all the help that we can get to make sure that we make the arrests and that we continue going into court with solid cases where we can get convictions and appropriate sentences.
Right. Which means the president's executive order 2 days ago about getting rid of cashless bail has to be implemented. And of course, these cities are going to sue back. Governor Kathy Hochul really thinks that she's going to snow the other 49 states into thinking that cashless bail has not been terrible for New York. Cut 15.
No, the president's wrong. He's flat out wrong. We don't have cashless bail in the state of New York. He thinks we do, but we don't. So he has no concept of how our laws work here. You know, we have made substantial changes to the bail laws, not once, but two consecutive sessions, which is why the budget was late. Those changes are working, and the data is bearing that out.
The data is bearing it out, but the lifestyle of the New York residents is not. Did she try to fix it? Yes. Did she fix it marginally? Yeah. but it's still an absolute mess. And Governor Cuomo's responsible for signing this into law. And now he's running for mayor while he's trying to walk away from it and be tough on crime. That's the problem. Curtis Sliwa, a much better alternative. He's third. And then Eric Adams just got into double digits in the last poll at 11%. But he is so terrible at hiring people, the people around him, handing out snack bags to reporters full of cash. It's like a joke. I mean, this guy's supposed to come back and win. He's got a bunch of endorsements, but he's not budging in the polls because people think he's incompetent and corrupt, even if the president has got rid of a lot of the charges, even though he's a better alternative than Mo Dahmy. And the reason why I bring up a mayor race in New York is because it's national. You got a mayor's race with a crazy socialist in Minneapolis, another one in Seattle, and they're emerging just about everywhere. But the fight back against crime, to me, is nuts. Listen to Zohram Mamdani, how he wants to have mental health experts respond to crimes. Cut 24.
New Yorkers rightfully have concerns around public safety, and I want to empower police officers to respond to serious crime and hire the mental health professionals to respond to mental health calls.
Exactly. So, you know that guy that, or the woman that spent those years in college, now you get your master's degree, then you got to get your PhD and your doctorate, and you become a psychologist, psychiatrist. Do you really want to get in your own car, drive up to a domestic dispute and see if you can find something psychologically wrong with a would-be assailant or somebody that seems to be overdosing and get to the heart of the matter and what they're really trying to escape? Or do you go in there with a life vac and a defibrillator and try to revive these people and quickly let them know that you can't beat up your partner anymore? And if you abuse drugs, you go to jail. But Mom Donnie's going to send in mental health professionals. That's not why they've got into this business, to go into hostile situations where they could get killed, in my view. But he knows better. Who is Mom Donnie? God Sad, who's from Lebanon originally, said this about what he thinks of this guy. He's one of these deep thinkers, best-selling authors. He said this to Jesse, cut 28.
I just wanted to mention about Mom Donnie and his inability to bench press. I actually talk about in The Parasitic Mind the relationship between physical formidability in men and their political orientation. And it may not surprise you to know, Jesse, that the more physically strong a man is, the less he's into egalitarianism, because strong men strive in competition, whereas wimpy men like Mamdani are going to be socialists. Let's spread the wealth. So I exactly predicted that he wouldn't be able to lift more than 5 pounds.
And what happened is he got, the bar is 45, and then he had 25 on each side. So he had 95 pounds on that bench press, and he could not lift it. So that's what he was talking about. And it matters. I mean, if you're not taking care of your body, you're not figuring fitness into it, that defines who you are. And this guy's a weak guy who has accomplished nothing, who wants to up double corporate tax, put up two more percent for the people in the upper class, the higher tax bracket, and he wants to take that money and redistribute it. Just that term. It's Bernie Sanders loves it. Not many other people do. All right, when we come back, I'll be able to get some calls. John Taffer, and then Dr. Arthur Brooks will be here a little bit later, Harvard professor, who's an expert on happiness. So if you're not feeling too upbeat, we're about to change all that if you keep it here on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
It's an amazing test case to show the similarities between the two, because both the Democrat Party and their attempted rebrand and Cracker Barrel, it shows that when you market test in Brooklyn, you lose in Birmingham, Alabama. When you try to just always pander towards a small subset of elite opinion, of out-of-touch actors, and then you have contempt and bitterness for the very country that you either wish that they want to buy your products from or to vote from you. So there is this very interesting connective tissue here, and it's not worth overthinking.
So that is Charlie Kirk weighing in, saying that there's a link between the Cracker Barrel rebrand and the fact that it bombed so bad, and everyone seemed caught by surprise. I think they lost $140 million. They seem to have gotten it back because it's a public-owned company. They don't serve alcohol. They wanted to bulk up. You know, look, if you go up to Fridays, Applebee's, Ruby Tuesdays, you know, the older franchises, they're not doing well. So you got to rebrand. You got to stay up with it. But I think Cracker Barrel in a unique niche, especially for those in the Midwest and the South. So there was loyalty there. Instead of trying to build on the loyalty, they said, let me just redo it and try to get different people. And that's what the big story is. And that's why I think a lot of people on the right took it personal, because it seems as though that's a conservative bastion where Cracker Barrel, kind of a hands-on situation, no-frills approach. But enough. The real story is Taylor and Travis. Travis Kelce is engaged now to Taylor Swift. And I think that, number one, when I saw them on the podcast, I thought to myself, is there a problem that they're not engaged yet? I mean, they're in their 30s. You know, what's the issue? Well, it turns out there is no issue. It was just timing. And I will tell you, from the football perspective, if I'm Andy Reid, I'm thinking to myself, couldn't you have done this in April and May? Because here they are. This is a high-profile team that wants the Super Bowl again. Kelce's trying to concentrate and try to rediscover his career. Last year was not a great year for him. And at that age, you don't know when you're going to just go out and just not have it anymore. And then this happens. I guess they could be used to it. They like the high power. They certainly wouldn't sell more sweatshirts. But I think the attraction with this is because Travis Kelce's known as a tough guy in a tough sport. And Taylor Swift has got all these artsy followers and next generation. They usually don't mix. As Taylor Swift said, are you going to be lining up against your brother in the Super Bowl? That's how little she knew about football. They're both on offense, the Eagles against the Chiefs. And she said, I knew nothing about football. She didn't care. That's really emblematic of all the fans, that most of the fans that follow Taylor Swift outside James Comey, who evidently looks at her as a great philosopher. So, and I'm not kidding. I don't know if you missed that or not. But here is Taylor Swift describing who Travis Kelce is. Cut 45.
I was just like, he's truly getting to know me in a way that's very natural, very pure, very normal. Like, also, like, just the way that he could make me laugh so immediately about normal things. Travis is like, he's just a vibe booster in everyone's life that he's in. He's like a human exclamation point. Like, he's like when you take a picture on your phone and you push the enhance color button. Yeah. That's like what you
do
to
why
everyone's
when I text,
life.
I'm always exclamations.
I use so many more exclamation points.
Yeah, well, let me say, I didn't even know the feature was on the iPhone. Is that true? You can enhance the color on your iPhone? Eric, do you know that?
Yeah, I think there's like a generic image enhance option if you go to edit on a photo. Yeah.
Oh, on a photo.
Right.
All right. So here's what she was talking about football, how little she knew. Cut 46.
Also, you're so non-judgmental about people. And you were not judgmental about the fact that I knew nothing about the world you were in.
It was the best.
You were nice. You were so nice.
I got a clean slate.
You were like, thank you.
You get a clean slate.
She doesn't know any of my bad stuff.
Are you kidding me?
Jason, on our first date, I legitimately asked him what it was like when the Chiefs played the Eagles in the Super Bowl, and he looked across the field, across the line of scrimmage, and saw his brother standing on the other, like 5 feet in front of him on the field.
Yeah.
And he was like, he didn't even look at me. Like, I now know what an insane question that was. He was like, actually, I'm on the offense and my brother's on the offense, and I'm only on the field at the same time as the defense. I thought everyone was out there at the same time.
That'll be 60 people in the field at the same time. Sorry. But so what happened is, it really is a boon for football, because all those people, a lot of women, all those people, teens, said, I'm going to go watch. Maybe I'll see her in the box. Maybe I'll get a chance to see Taylor Swift. And then who's this guy, Travis Kelce? I believe he catches the ball. I'm going to root for him. So they turned off they turned on a whole group of people. So not only is Travis Kelce dating a high-profile person, but he's with a high-profile team that's won two Super Bowls. So they go in for a third Super Bowl. So you see him all throughout the playoffs, create some resentment perhaps. But I think both of them are reasonably likable. Even the president weighed in on their relationship, and I thought, uh-oh, here we go. Look, good luck. He's going to go Meghan Markle him and just point out what we all know about Meghan Markle and ruin Harry's life. He's going to bring up that. He said, no, two great people, very talented. I wish him all the best. See, that's a president of the United States who's really coming into his own. right? He's kind of positive about the whole thing. So that was a big story yesterday. They got engaged. So we'll see the big distraction. The other big story is how much better the Giants are going to be this year. That's pretty cool. So the President of the United States is going to have a conference today about Gaza. And it's going to be at the White House. They're going to chair a large meeting to discuss the comprehensive plan that the administration is putting together for the post-war management of Gaza, should we ever get there. It appears to be the first time that Witkoff revealed that yesterday. So Israel will welcome the idea. It was roundly rejected by U.S. partners when the president brought up, we'll take over Gaza and we'll clean it up and finish it. Nobody really wanted that. So we'll see if this is any better when it comes to Gaza. But here's Steve Witkoff on the chances of peace. So what's going on? Did the both sides agree to this or not? Cut nine.
Hamas.
Sorry, 100%.
Right. Yes. There's been a deal on the table for the last 6 or 7 weeks that would have released 10 of the hostages out of the 20 who we think are alive.
See, I thought there was more than 10 of the 20 alive. I thought 20 were alive, and there were 50 total. See, the first time I heard that 10 of the 20 are alive, that's stunning to me. I mean, 10 more people died. So if the deal is accepted, why are they not going through the deal? Steve, why are they not doing the deal? If Netanyahu's not doing it, there's got to be a reason. He needs some help. He's doing too much. John Tapper's next. We'll talk about the economy. We're also going to talk about Cracker Barrel. And John Tapper's the best in the business. He knows what works.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
The feedback and the buzz is so good, not only from our customers, but from our team members. They want to work in a wonderful restaurant. So we're doing everything for our guests and our team members.
So that's what they did. The CEO of Cracker Barrel, who decided to change their logo and approach. And Pete, the backlash was one of the biggest backlash I've ever seen for a marketing restaurant situation. Cracker Barrel found itself at odds with his fans, with its supporters, with his Uncle Herschel logo, who was taken off, and the stock dropped 140 worth in terms of overall worth $140 million. Then they decided, we made a mistake, let's go back to the way it was. John Taffer, host of Bar Rescue, author of The Power of Conflict, an expert in all things restaurant related. John, have you ever seen a marketing plan like this blow up so epically?
No, it's actually unbelievable, Brian. Think about this for a second. There was a design team involved that came up with an interior concept, a graphic company that had to come up with the graphic logo, the executive team that had to approve everything. Every one of them get paid, really, to know their customer, right? To attach themselves to the likes of their customers. Every one of them completely blew it, Brian. It isn't just a logo. They took that interior and they want to paint it white. Drastic change. And, you know, brands like Cracker Barrel survive on authenticity. It's not a new brand, Brian, where you can change it, wiggle it, move it. And we've seen things like this in the past. Remember Kentucky Fried Chicken became KFC, but they didn't change their identity. They wanted to sort of make the word fried disappear. And International House of Pancakes became IHOP, because they didn't want to just be known for pancakes. So there's ways to do this effectively. This almost reminds me of the new Coke in a way.
Because if it failed and they had a quick reverse course, and it got a lot of attention for the old Coke when it did come back, right? It dominated the news cycle.
It did. And think about what Cracker Barrel could be doing. See, I wouldn't have gone back to the new logo. First of all, I would disempower the team that made these decisions. I wouldn't let them make any more decisions going forward. Second of all, I would say, you know what? We heard you. Let's run a contest and let's put forth 4 or 5 new fun logos and let's involve our customers and let's spread this out for another couple of weeks so we can get a little more media coverage as voting happens and they pick the new logo. I get a hit on a new logo, Brian, in 3 weeks. Then I can launch a new menu item. Then I can say I'm not changing the interior. We're just going to make it better. And suddenly I can get another 4 to 5 weeks out of this, win my customers over, and turn it into a positive marketing campaign. But, Brian, obviously they're not smart enough to do that.
They're not. They should call you, John. You have a fee, but you would still supply that great information. So, John, the other thing is, there did need to be some changes. They did need something. I mean, it was not a restaurant that was humming along that tried to change things for no reason, right?
Absolutely right. But there's ways to do it, Brian. You introduce new menu items. You can introduce a smokehouse box on your menu, a special type of culinary direction or new items. You can take the menu, which is sort of a newspapery kind of a format, and turn it into a new format for the menu and present the food in a more contemporary way. But you don't do it drastically at this. You don't take something and change the logo, change the interior, change it all, and slap your customers in the face. There's an evolution that happens. And when you do it in bites like that, Brian, you can do it in a step, see how it's received. Ooh, okay, it's working. Then you go to the next step. Ah, it's working. Oh, no, they pushed back. Let's not go to the next step. There's a smart way to do it where you protect the shareholders and you still adapt to the likes and dislikes of your customers.
Are there problems?
You know, many years ago.
Go ahead.
Many years ago, Brian, I ran Grossinger's in the Catskill Mountains, which was a famous resort. And Grossinger's in the Catskill Mountains was, you know, that Jewish resort area upstate New York. I'm sure you know it. And it died. And it died because their customers died. They had a customer base, and they didn't get to the next generation. And we've seen that happen with brands over the years. Howard Johnson's comes to mind. Remember, they dominated the restaurant space. And they lost when they didn't attach the next generation. That's the challenge that Cracker Barrel has. How do they maintain who they are and yet reach out to that next generation to keep their customer base growing? That's their challenge. And a way to do it is not drastically.
So let me ask you, do you think there's a problem with the whole franchise concept right now? The Applebee's, the Fridays, the Ruby Tuesdays, they don't seem to have the heat on them, the affordable opportunity with the fun atmosphere. It doesn't seem to have that.
Well, I think that, yes, I think that to some degree, I don't think there's an issue with franchise restaurants. I think it's all about the brand and how they execute. You know, Fridays was a client of mine, in full disclosure, for many, many years. And they got rid of the striped awnings, remember that? And they got rid of the antiques on the wall. But what happened is, in many cases, the pandemic caused these companies to get into discount mode. And Applebee's had the all-you-can-eat appetizer for $5, I think. And, you know, people get addicted to discounts. I think many of these brands, they created discount programs out of desperation. When you discount, you lose revenue, and then you don't have the money to address the concept and upgrade the concept. This is an interesting dynamic today, Brian. The younger generation doesn't care about legacy brands. They don't care about the history of a brand as much. They're much more about being relevant, being hip, being connective. And that's why older brands have to always focus on their connectivity in today's marketplace. If they can keep that connectivity and don't let it disappear and try to rebuild it 5 years later, if they can keep it in real time and understand that's their objective is connectivity every day, these concepts can evolve and stay relevant. The problem is they fall behind on connectivity and catch up doesn't work very well.
So a couple of things. When you look at the economy right now, when you talk to small restaurateurs and big franchises, how do they feel the state of the economy is? What's the greatest concern?
Well, I think that there's a concern of fear, of course, but some of it depends upon what side of the political aisle you're on, candidly, Brian. You know, I think our liberal friends are thinking the sky is going to fall and they're all freaking out. I think our conservative friends, you know, see a future, see a plan, see some consistency, see some stability in the future. I get a good feeling from the restaurant industry right now. I know there are some brands that are struggling. Our Taffer's Taverns are doing great, Brian. We open our third Atlanta location in about 3 weeks, and we open on International Drive in Orlando in about 3 weeks. So again, it's about brands being connective, not only with the customers, but with their franchisees too. So some do great, some not so much. And it's all about that connectivity that we spoke about. And you know, involvement in a restaurant, when it's connected to the marketplace and its customers, it does great.
So let's talk about the tariffs. What have you seen in different parts of the country? How are they being affected? The farmers who put a food on our table and sell to other countries, things are, you know, it's hard to keep up with all these trade deals.
it is hard to keep up with all the trade deals. The good news is that the sky hasn't fallen, and all the predictions that we've heard of recession and massive inflation, none of these things, in fact, have happened, Brian. So I'm pleased to see that the tariff program seems quite manageable, not highly impactful in the day-to-day marketplace. But one has to look at the overall package of Trump to understand it. And I'm not about Trump. I'm about policy. When you take a look at the tax reductions and you take a look at the lowered inflation rates and the lower energy costs, so if tariffs affect in a negative sense inflation a little bit, the overall package is extremely positive. So I think we have to take a look at the plan, not necessarily isolated parts of that plan. And in my view, it's working. Look, our GMP is working. Inflation is down at a very, very a respectable level right now at about, I think, 2.7 is where we're sitting right about now. Unemployment, pretty much full employment at about 4.2%. Border is closed. Every promise that he's made, he's keeping. I think the actions in Washington, D.C., whereby is certainly been turned into a political exercise, in the end, are going to be proven to be a very good move by him, and the city's going to be better for it, and it's going to be hard for America to ignore that. One thing bothers me, Brian, and it's haunting me a little bit. And I love that our president is running our country like a business, because it is. But this equity thing, when we take a look at the microchip industry and the premises, and I won't get into mentioning company names, I guess, but
Intel.
You know, the premise is that if America puts up billions of dollars to subsidize an industry like microchips or whatever it is, that then that company that receives that dollar would give 10% equity to America. Now, on a surface, that might say, okay, well, we're investing in that company, let's get a return. But Brian, who votes those shares? And would you invest in a company that's competing against the American government?
I hear you. I mean, for example, Lockheed Martin is a defense contractor. The president said, you know, we're going to give a big contract. Why don't the American people own a piece of that? Well, what if I'm competing against Lockheed Martin for a contract?
That's complete. Correct. It opens up a Pandora's box of conflicts and unfairness that I'm extremely uncomfortable with. But there are solutions, Brian. You know, we could turn around and say, listen, we want a 3% licensing fee on all of these microchips off the top, not the bottom, until this debt is paid, plus a fair interest rate. So we protect its shareholders. A licensing fee is off the top, not the bottom. So we're not involved in their P&L. We're not involved in the way they run the company. And it's nice and clean that way, and there's no conflict or issues. So I get where the president's at. He's trying to protect the American taxpayer. I think it's fantastic. I just think there's a better way to go about it. And I think the licensing approach is a simple way to do it. It's secure. It's legal. And it doesn't put the American government in the business affairs of the entity.
John, check out John Taffer, Bar Rescue, another season, right?
Another season. We just finished shooting season 10. Unbelievable, Brian. 15 years, buddy.
Yeah, you got it. John Taffer, always great. Thanks so much.
Good to talk. Be well.
See, John is happy. He knows happiness. Dr. Arthur Brooks is a doctor of happiness. He's a Harvard professor, columnist. His new book is out. It's called The Happiness File, Insights on Work and Life. Besides that, he doesn't really tackle big issues. Back in a moment.
Miss a show? Have to tune out early? No problem. Download the podcast at BrianKilmeadeShow.com. Every episode, exclusive interviews, on demand. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
It's the Will Cain Show. Watch it live at noon Eastern, Monday through Thursday on FoxNews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss a show. Get the podcast 5 days a week at FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
So we're just following this other breaking story that there's been a shooting in Minneapolis at a Catholic school. It looks like there are fatalities. The gunman's dead. Sadly, we've been through this so many times before. I'll give you the details as we get them. But let's make the transition to happiness. Not easy, but we'll do it. Dr. Arthur Brooks does it every day. He's a Harvard professor, teaches a course on that, Atlantic columnist, host of Office Hours podcast, and best-selling author, and this book certainly to be best-selling as well. It's called The Happiness Files, Insights on Work and Life. Arthur, welcome back.
Hey, Brian. Nice to see you, as always.
What do you bring to the table here in this? Is this more of what you learned teaching this class, or how you've evolved learning more about this?
Well, this new book, The Happiness Files, is the 33 most popular columns I've written in the Atlantic for the past 5 years. And it's basically a manual on how to enjoy your job more, how to make other people happier around you, and actually how to come home a happier person when you come home from work is what it comes down to.
What if you don't like that job?
If you don't like that job, then it talks about how you can make it into something it's actually more productive until you can find a new job. Here's the thing. You know, I was doing a show not long ago, a television show, and somebody in the studio audience, I was talking to the studio audience, and somebody said, like, I feel like a drone in a cubicle. I hate my job. What can I do? And the answer is, you actually make life better for the people around you. Go to the break room at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and come back with a fresh cup of coffee and say to the guy in the next cubicle, you look like you can use a fresh cup of coffee, and look at the look on his face. The truth is, lighten the load for somebody else. You'll feel better today and you'll become that guy.
So instead of focusing on your happiness, you go ahead and try to make somebody else happy and you'll get that reflection.
This is the secret. If you want help, be the helper is what it comes down to. Give the thing that you actually want to get. The same thing is true in every part of life, Brian. I mean, you and I have been married men for a super long time. And we all know that when you're feeling hostility towards your wife, the first thing you should give is more love, notwithstanding your feelings, and everything's going to be better. Give the thing you want to get.
I actually didn't know I should do that. I just learned something now, and I got that for free.
No, when you're actually feeling like, I want to avoid her, that's when you say, bring it in.
So Zig Ziglar had something very similar, if I see if I can get this right. You can get what you want if you help enough people get what they want.
Right. That's true. That's certainly true in sales. But one of the great truths in life is you can get what you want by giving other people what you want. That's what it comes down to, because other people want the same thing. They want courtesy. You don't feel like being courteous because the airline is delaying your flight. Be courteous, despite your feelings. You'll manage yourself and you'll get more of the thing that you actually want and feel better about yourself starting today.
When's the last time you really felt like you were angry? And obviously, in your line of work, you probably felt bad about it. But, you go to the airline attendant, and they're not telling you the truth about your plane, and you could have gone on another plane, and you're late for work, and you got to get to Harvard, you got to teach a class, you got a column that could have been done, but your computer's in your luggage, and you can't even work on what you're supposed to do. Yeah. You're frustrated. When's the last time you felt those emotions and let that dominate your mindset?
Well, you know, I have an advantage on this, which is that I teach happiness and I do happiness in public, and people sometimes recognize me in airports, and it's a bad look if I'm being a jerk. You know, being committed to being a happiness professor makes you nicer is what it comes down to. I mean, the truth is, I feel emotions just like everybody else. There's a part of your brain that actually processes emotions automatically. It's called the limbic system. The problem is that when you're being managed by your emotions as opposed to managing your emotions, and I've gotten much better, especially over the past 20 years, of managing my own emotions, because I know the science on how to get it done. And that's a lot of what I teach and what I speak and write about. And that's this book in my podcast, Office Hours. And in this new book, The Happiness Files, you learn how to manage yourself.
The relationship between wealth and security and happiness.
Yeah. Money doesn't buy happiness. What it does is it eliminates sources of unhappiness, is what you find. And so happiness and unhappiness are not opposites. That, as a matter of fact, they're processed in different parts of the brain. And what happens with money is that when you have very, very little of it, your unhappiness from avoidable sources is pretty high. And money can actually eliminate those sources. But don't go looking for the happiness that you really want by getting more money. That's not going to work. What brings more happiness is more love.
So when I talked to Phil Knight, he said, I was reading his book and stressed reading it. He's trying to get the sneakers done. He can't make his payments. He can't make his payroll. He gets the money. He doesn't get the money. The interest rate's too high. He's worried about the Japanese delivery.
Right.
And I read this and I said, man, aren't you glad that's over?
Yeah.
You know, when you go through that, he goes, no, I loved it.
Yeah.
Can you love something that appears stressful?
Yeah, all the time. High performers are addicted to it, as a matter of fact. And everybody can actually learn and grow from the most anxious periods of their lives. That's one of the reasons that people always look back to the times when they were sad in college and look back on it and laugh with the friends that they had during that period, because they learned a lot during that. You know, I say, hey, Brian, tell me about when you really understood best the meaning of your life. You're not going to tell me about that week at Disneyland. You're going to talk about things that were hard for you, hard parts of the early part of your career, that you persisted, that you were resilient, you know, and that's a really important thing. And really successful people figure that out.
What do you do with, how do you get, if you're trying to get to the mountaintop, like an Olympian, and you get your gold medal, this is the best example. In life, your gold medal might be CEO of something, or it might be the vice presidency, or it might be
graduating from college.
Or your dry cleaning company finally is successful, whatever it is. When you get that, inevitably they say there's a letdown after.
Yeah.
Does that show you that you were doing it for the wrong reasons?
No. What that is, that's called a rival fallacy. So we in the world of psychology, it's the problem is that we love progress toward a goal. We have to have goals in life. You got to have goals. That's called purpose, and purpose is part of the meaning of life. It's like it's a serious business, and you got to make progress toward those goals, and that gives you that gives you desire, that gives you motivation, and it gives you a lot of happiness. The problem is that you make the mistake of thinking that when you actually acquire the thing, you get the goal, that then you'll be happier than you ever were before and it's going to last. And that's wrong. That's the reason that a lot of Olympic gold medalists suffer depression. Your emotions don't persist. They're not supposed to persist. That's not why they actually exist. And so you need to understand that. And the answer is intention without attachment.
Love it. What a cliffhanger. The name of the book is The Happiness Files, Insights on Work and Life. Arthur Brooks, thanks so much. Pick up the book.
Hey, I'm Trey Gowdy, host of the Trey Gowdy Podcast. I hope you will join me every Tuesday and Thursday as we navigate life together and hopefully find ourselves a little bit better on the other side.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com.
From the Fox News Radio Studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here. Thanks so much for listening. We got a big hour coming your way. Sadly, I have a school shooting to try to watch at the same time as do the show. It happened in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The police are responding to a shooting. It looks like there are fatalities. It looks like a grammar school to eighth grade about. And as the kids are being brought out, the school uniforms are prevalent. And we'll try to get some details there. The local people are commenting, and the shooter we know is dead. We just don't know any details, and the motive obviously is one of the last things to come. So with that, let's get to Karl Rove. Karl, Deputy Chief of Staff for George W. Bush, Fox News contributor, best-selling author. Karl, here we go again. Again, this is in Minneapolis. I mean, we had the horrific schools, that shooting of these politicians. And now we have something else going on in this city.
Yeah, so sad. I mean, school is coming back, and the last thing a parent wants to worry about is their child going into a battle zone. And so sad.
Absolutely. We'll follow that story as it happens. So, Karl, let's talk about what's happening with crime in this country. Over 80% of the people say it's a problem that needs to be addressed. 54% approve of the way the president's handling it. But almost every Democrat is mocking the president and daring him to put National Guard in and do what they're doing in D.C. You have Illinois, Governor Hochul here in New York, and Governor Gavin Newsom, of course, and Mayor Bass of Los Angeles last month. Your thoughts about how this is all playing out?
Yeah, look, if you go back through history, the big cities in our country, the Democrat mayors were, sort of blue collar, working class, many places Catholic, and they had a great relationship with the first responders, the police and the firemen and the first responders, the EMS people. They tended to be Democrats because they lived in a Democrat town. And yet, as the Democratic Party became increasingly, sort of soft on crime, whether it was in the 1960s when President Richard Nixon got elected by speaking out on behalf of the silent majority and campaigning on law and order, or take New York, your city, in the late 70s and the 80s and the early 90s, it declined in safety. And they did an amazing thing. They elected a Republican mayor for the first time in, 40 some odd years. And then followed him with it. Remember, Mike Bloomberg, when he first ran in 2001, was running as a Republican. I mean, we had Dick Reardon out in California, in Los Angeles, Republican mayor of Los Angeles. Why? In part because of concerns about disorder in the streets. And the Democrats don't seem to get it. They don't seem to get that when they stand up and say, defund the police or cashless bail or it's not really a problem. I mean, people, particularly in New York, see it in so many aspects of their life that they know that's not true.
And in fact, they said it. I mean, you're watching what's happening in Minneapolis now as they're mysteriously, it baffles me. They're having their autopsy in front of the cameras. I mean, and listen to the, some of this meltdown. Listen to this. This woman, Ada Barracino, a DNC member, Cut 32.
I'm from California, and I just, you know, just like Florida, we've had a tremendous amount of raids. I, you know, we're dealing with different circumstances here, but I've said this a lot, but Latinos in California are dealing with this ICE crisis that mirrors, you know, I think we're living worse times than the times of sorry about that, of the pandemic. It is just grueling.
She all goes on to say that even people, just Hispanics that are there legally, are still aren't going to work because they're so concerned, so afraid.
Yeah.
Is that how you read the crackdown on immigration?
Look, that whole meeting was weird. I mean, you know, they could not bring themselves to say illegals. It was documented and undocumented. In fact, it was sort of a litany. They kept saying that. They would refer to the American people and say, well, it's both documented and undocumented. Look, imagine what would happen if the Democrats stood up and said, you know what, we stand with the president in finding these criminals who have violated our laws and threatened the safety of our neighborhoods and our communities and getting them off the streets and out of the country. But where we draw the line is people who came here, unfortunately, you know, illegally, many of them many, many years ago. And since then, they've contributed to our economy and to our society, and they've kept their nose clean and paid their taxes and been, you know, good residents of our communities. And we want to draw a line there. I mean, it would at least put them on the right side when it came to crime and law and order. And it would give them something where frankly, the majority of the American people agree with them. People in this country overwhelmingly want to do something to get the people who are bad actors off of the streets and out of our country. They have a different attitude towards people who have come here and have tried to make a life and have kept their nose clean and contributed to their to our economy and their communities.
I'm not one of them. I think that if people have been here over 10 years, 15 years, and they can get their boss to sign off on them, there could be some extended work visa, not citizenship.
Right.
I'm for that. And I never even would bring it up because I would say, first, you got to seal the border. And I never thought it was going to be sealed. And they did it. So having said that, I think we have a possibility. But I was shocked to see a poll that said 53% of Republicans are for everybody here illegally out. You must have seen that.
Yeah. Well, I'm with you. I'm not with that 53%. And frankly, I think the more that happens, the smaller that number is going to be because they're going to realize what an economic problem that's going to be. I'm like you. No guarantee of citizenship. If you want to become a citizen, go to the back of the line. You know, wait the next 18 years. But in the meantime, you know, we want your employer to track you. So we give a report every year, you know, that you're behaving. We're going to check to make certain you're paying your taxes, that you don't violate the law. And, you know, let's as a country say, if we've got gang members coming into this country and we've got violent representatives of, you know, violence in our communities because of people who come here legally, get them and get rid of them. But and Democrats would be smart to do that. But instead, that whole meeting was like, I mean, it started so weirdly. I mean, they had that woman who stood up, you know, a member of the DNC from Minnesota, an Indian American and representative of the Dakota tribe. And the first thing she does is stand up and say, I am a indigenous queer woman. Well, really, have we gotten to the point where you can't simply say, I'm, you know, Susie Jones, representative,
exactly,
you know, of the National Committee here. And then she goes and does the acknowledgement of, you know, how terrible that we, the Dakotas, who were responsible for the entire Mississippi River, you know, and you stole our land and blah, 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 blah. But that's how they began their meeting. And most Americans, if they bothered to turn in and to tune into that, would say, you know, who are you people? How weird are you? I mean, that wasn't normal. And if anything, Americans want normality in their politics and these strange, you know, it's worse than COVID. Well, let me tell you, I was in COVID. We all were. Today is not worse than COVID. You know, it's just not. And, you know, when Democrats seem like they're out of touch with ordinary people, they are out of touch.
But Carl, here's the thing. They're obsessed with Trump, even worse in many ways than 2016 to 2020. They thought they were just going to get rid of him, and they got him on Russia, and then they got to get him again on the Ukraine conversation. And now that he's back, they're still obsessed with him. I mean, does anyone have a big picture to understand that Trump is going to be done and that there's got to be a way to fight another day? In fact, the bulk of their game plan is going to come to fruition in 2028. Why are they focusing on what they don't like about Trump the entire time?
Yeah, well, they ought to be focused on finding ways to say to the American people, we're with you and he isn't. And, you know, we have a vision that he's not about making your life better, and he doesn't care about that. But instead, they got to stand up and say, I'm an indigenous queer woman, and, you know, shame on you for taking the Dakota lands away from us and creating the state of Minnesota. And let's have a big debate about whether or not we're going to simply cut off all aid to Israel or whether we're going to castigate Israel. That was their choice. I mean, it's just, you know, and you're right. The anger at Trump, I mean, the speech by the Democratic National Chairman where he basically said, I'm going to be as vulgar and as angry and use as many nasty words as I think Donald Trump is using against us. And, I mean, look, you know, he is inside their brain. And everything that they do is a response to him. And when the reality, if they were smart, they'd be saying, what is it that we need to do to get ourselves back in the good graces with the American voter?
And that's what they should do. And what you do is you got to try to make people's lives better and say, look, the border's been sealed. Would have done it differently. But this is where we go from here. When it comes to inflation, you know, we've spent too much early on. But the president has brought it down as I'll give him the as quick as he said he was going to. But it's still at 2.6%. He wants it at 2%. And it's he's not the first president to harangue a Fed chairman. So because he wants the interest rates down. And for the most part, almost every economist here in the Fox Business Channel, not just Larry Kudlow, thinks they should be down. So that's Trump style. So I'm very curious to see if they're going to get a game plan. I know Ezra Klein wrote a book to say, you know, we're annoying people. I watched Fareed Zakaria, meaning Democrats are. We're just annoying people. The cancel culture, the judgmentalness, the apologizing for America is not working. I watched Fareed Zakaria say, why don't we just admit it? Every major city has got crime problems and infrastructure problems, and it's run by Democrats. You know that he hated saying that. But at some point, I would love it for the country, for someone like Joe Manchin, if he's the right person, if he was younger, to walk up and just say, hey, this is what I like Trump's doing. This is what I don't. This is why I'd be different. I would love a Harold Ford. I would feel so much better about the country if there was a Harold Ford type politician running against it, you know, whether it's Trump or a Bush or whatever. Then I just say the country is not going to be dramatically different no matter who wins. But if there is a left wing reaction to Trump and an AOC becomes president, can you imagine the head snapping change?
Well, first of all, if they ran an AOC, they'd lose. Think about this, Brian. Think about this. You mentioned California earlier, and you had the woman from California, a DNC member. Think about this. Remember, we had the soft-on-crime prosecutor, Budin, in San Francisco, recalled because he was too soft on crime. We had school board members in San Francisco recalled because they wanted to change the name of Abraham Lincoln High School.
Yep.
We had the George Cascone, the DA in Los Angeles, beaten, I think it was 65-35, by Nathan Hochman, who's a Republican in the city of Los Angeles. We had the prosecutor in Alameda County, Oakland, very liberal. You know, Berkeley, California is there. She was recalled because she was too soft on crime. And, you know, we have these instances, you know, Portland, Oregon, we had the soft on crime prosecutor in Multnomah County. You talk about a left wing part of the country. My uncle used to live there. Man, God dang, talk about the left wing. And he gets defeated by a career prosecutor who is a lifelong registered Republican. Imagine what would happen to the Democrats if they got 10% fewer votes in cities like New York and Boston and Chicago and San Francisco and Los Angeles. I mean, literally, they're getting beaten in these places by people who are conservative on crime and, in some instances, registered Republicans.
I know you're not a math guy, but you know what? You seem to know everything about everything. But when you see the tariff money coming in, controversy wherever you stand on tariffs, it's okay. You know, conservatives are like Larry and other people fundamentally have been against it. Stephen Moore has been against it. But they're seeing the revenue come in. Are you thinking to yourself, we have to do things like this to try to balance our budget and reorganize our trade? Is this a way to begin to reduce the deficit?
Well, A, the money has to go to reduce the deficit. That is to say, we've got to control spending and take whatever money's tax revenues are coming in and apply them to reducing the annual debt. The annual deficit, and thereby reducing the growth of the national deficit. But let's be clear. I know about tariffs. I wrote a book about Mr. Protection himself, William McKinley. $300 billion this year. Part of that will be paid by the companies that are importing those goods by shaving their margins. Some of it will be paid for by the people who sell us that by cutting their margins. Some of it will be taken care of in the play between the currencies. But the vast bulk of it is going to be paid by the consumer. So we're putting a, whatever it is, $250 billion tax on ultimately on the consumers. You know, in the first quarter of the year, or the first half of the year, that may have been mostly the company selling and the company's buying, but ultimately it's going to be the consumer who buys it. You cannot put a 25% tariff on a good and expect the company to be already making a 25% profit. That's not how the world works. Profit margins outside of tech are not that big. So, there are two issues here. A, make certain that any additional revenues we've got go not to more spending, but to reducing the amount of money that we are running in the red each year, and hopefully reduce the deficit. But second of all, let's recognize it's a tax on people that is not progressive at all. It's going to fall with the same impact upon a family making $80,000 a year. They're going to pay, you know, X percent more on what they buy, as well as somebody who's got a much larger income. And as a result, it's going to be harder for people in the middle and the bottom to deal with these. You send your kids back to school this fall, and you're buying tennis shoes that are made in, you know, fill in the blank of Malaysia, and you're buying jeans that are being fabricated in Bangladesh, and you're going to pay 20 or 25% more for them. Just the way of the world.
We'll see.
When you slap a 25% tariff on them,
or that Malaysian group opens up a factory in America within 2 years and they avoid everything. And that's part of the other goal of this, right?
Well, you may be right about some things, but there are certain industries that are low cost, are low wage, low skilled jobs that are simply not coming back. We are not going to be making blue jeans in the United States in the foreseeable future, not on a mass scale. We're not going to be making tennis shoes.
To save money, I'm going to begin making my own. I'm buying sheets of blue jeans, and I'm going to take my measurements a little bit later. Carl Rove, always insightful, always great. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it, Brian.
Meanwhile, we're following that story with the shooting in the city of Minneapolis. We are hearing that there are 5 children in the hospital right now. That's all we could tell you. Don't move.
Both sides, all opinions. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Information you want, truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
All right, I'll be able to get to your calls right after this, but real quick to update you on the school shooting at the Catholic school in Minneapolis. It looks like there's about 5 to 10 kids who were hurt and hospitalized. The number is now 15 to 20 injured in Minneapolis at the shooting. That according to one source. We do know some of the kids are at the hospital, some of the people, there could be some teachers in there, security officials, and it does look like the shooter killed himself afterwards. So we're watching everybody stream out of the schools. We're also seeing getting reports and speculation about what took place, but there could be a situation where the shots rung out and it's debris that gets you hurt. That's what I hope, rather than a direct shot. and we'll see what's going on. But anytime you're shooting up a grammar school, just by saying that, you know it's a tragedy. When we come back, we'll take your calls on everything, and Chris Swecker will be giving us an update of former assistant director of the FBI in just a moment. Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Will Kane Country. Watch it live at noon Eastern, Monday through Thursday at FoxNews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss the show. Listen and follow the podcast 5 days a week at FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
So school shootings going on again. School's back. What? Most places haven't even back yet. In the East, we wait till after Labor Day. They do it earlier in different places. Minneapolis is an example. A Catholic school was just under fire. 15 to 20 are hurt. I'm not sure who students, teachers, security. But now it looks like 6 children are being treated at Children's Hospital. I imagine students. We'll try to find out more details, but we know the shooter's dead. It looks like he took his own life. Chris Swecker joins us now. Chris, former assistant director of the FBI. Chris, from what we know, what could you tell our audience about the incident that took place about an hour ago?
Yeah, Brian, it appears that someone dressed in black with possibly an AK shooting 223 rounds, which are high-powered rounds, was outside a Catholic church in Minneapolis and fired inside. By all reports thus far, I mean, the facts are still coming in, but thus far what we think is that this shooter shot from the outside in. That may change, but when we hear or see the press conference from local law enforcement, but be that as it may, there are multiple casualties. It's beyond tragic. Young children. You know, I do school security assessments. In fact, I did a Catholic church very recently, a pretty large one in the school. And when you have young children, it becomes a lot more complicated because they don't have options. You can't do run, hide, fight with young children. You almost have to lock them down because it just gets too chaotic and they don't have the judgment to do the run and hide part that has to be done for them. So, you know, they're all congregated in one place. Again, this is your worst nightmare. If they're in classrooms, you can seal them off, ideally with just one push of an access control button. But in this case, they're all gathered in one place. So some of these injuries may be from glass. Some may be from just stampeding. We'll see. We'll pray that they're minor injuries.
So you said outside a church or outside the school? There's a church next to the school?
They were. My information is they were in a mass. Oh. They were in a mass that's held before school or during school, and they were all in the chapel. That may change, and my information may not be correct, but that's what I'm hearing.
So a guy in a mask, since dead. Did you also heard they took his own life?
I've read that. What we're hearing is the shooter is down, and there's no further threat. I have heard that he took his own life. I have not heard that responders or whether there was a school resource officer there that exchanged fire. I mean, we haven't heard that he's down at the hands of law enforcement. The majority of the reports or all the reports I've heard, it was by his own hand.
So what do you want to, if your kid was going to school right now, no matter who's ever listening to us, might have a kid, grandkid, whatever it is, you might be in school right now. What do you ask that school to see if they are ready to handle something like this?
Yeah, as I said, I do a lot of school security assessments, universities as well. You want to make sure that they have deterrence in place, that is visible security. So I always 100% of the time recommend an armed off-duty police officer. That's your first choice. You know, you can hire private guards, but you need a police presence. I know that a lot of schools don't want that, you know, that martial-looking appearance of an officer outside, but these are the times that we live in. And number two, they have to have access controls so that they can control access during classes, during activities that are taking place during the day. You want an early warning system in place where if red flags are raised, as there were at Parkland, that you have a small team of different people from different you know, different disciplines that can come together and assess the threat and decide how to intervene if there's an opportunity for intervention. That sort of that follow those red flags. There's a whole myriad of things. You have to train your security response, your crisis response, and make sure that everybody knows what to do. Again, a lot of schools don't want to do that because they don't want to scare the kids and the staff. But this is we live in these times. What you see today, you have to have a well-trained, you know, well-defined response. And you can't be guessing what you're going to do. There has to be a notification system that's reliable that can get to as many people as possible and give them the information they need to either lock down or do implement some other crisis protocol.
The other thing would be in Minneapolis in particular, I mean, they seem to be somewhat unhinged. The cops are overmatched. I mean, what are they,
right.
400 cops down? So it's maybe
right.
not easy. I know in my town, they have a different surge alert. So we have all these grammar schools and high schools within a certain radius, and we have people planted and just waiting. If they had the surge, they'll be there in 3 minutes. When you don't have a lot of resources, you don't have a lot of cops. It's hard to get retired cops to do that. That's what we got, retired cops looking to surge in situations like that.
Yeah, ideally, the gold standard for security at a school or a university or even a church sometimes is to have an off-duty police officer with a marked unit parked somewhere nearby
yeah.
to deter anyone from doing something like this. You know, and I dealt with this as the head of security for Bank of America. When we put armed guards outside the bank, they didn't get robbed. It'd take a really crazy person to try to shoot it out with an armed police officer. And when I say armed police officer, I mean someone who has the resources of the police department at his fingertips. One walkie-talkie call, or one HT call, and he can get he can invoke an emergency response that has the entire shift coming in your direction, and very quickly. So, you know, a lot of universities, a lot of schools don't like to have this type of look outside their school. But in this day and age, I think it's absolutely necessary, and you have to bite the bullet and deal with the expenses of it. It's not that expensive.
Yeah. What does it say about the mindset of the shooter that they're going for children, that they're going for targets? They don't want to be in a gunfight. They want to slaughter.
Awful. You know, it has to be a special type of mental illness or evil that does this sort of thing. I mean, it's not the first time we've seen it. Uvalde, Columbine, others. And it takes a very sick person to do this. You know, as you said, Brian, especially with young kids, and this appears to be targeted. Doesn't look like this is an accident that they were all congregated in one place at the same time. And this person who was dressed in black, with a high-powered rifle, shoots into the mass that was taking place. I mean, that is a targeted situation. We know that. I mean, we don't know this, but I highly suspect this is not random. And I know that by now he's probably been identified, and they're at his house or his car, trying to get his devices, trying to sort of backtrack, do a thorough analysis of his social media presence and his contacts, and try to get to the bottom of why did he did this? Why would he do this?
Good question. Why would he? I mean, that's going to be the ultimate thing. And of course, somebody's going to be twisted, be able to do that. And we'll find out. And that's going to be the big debate on guns. You have to know 50 states. And please don't feel bad if you don't. But do you know the gun laws in Minnesota? I know it's a big hunting state. But do you know?
Yeah.
Because that's what we always hear. It's going to be about the gun laws. If you talk to the Democrats,
yeah.
it's going to be about the gun. You talk to Republicans, it's going to be the people need psychological help.
Yeah, there's local gun laws. And I don't know, what Minneapolis has. There's federal gun laws as well. And some states, as you know, are more restrictive. Some are more liberal. Texas, and where I am in North Carolina, you need a permit. I mean, you can carry openly. You can do open carry, if you will. But if you have a concealed weapon, you need to get a permit. What I always look at, and this is a discussion that's held every single time, is this idea of a red flag law, which I, as a former law enforcement officer, I like. If someone is flashing red, if you will, especially if they're tender years or they're young and they you know, there's a thing called a domestic violence restraining order that you can get for domestic violence. Well, this would be no different. You would get a restraining order to prevent some person from getting their hands on this type of weapon. I think it's something that law enforcement would appreciate. Most of the law enforcement colleagues of mine think it's a good idea if it's implemented the right way. It gives you at least one opportunity, and this would happen in Parkland, to prevent guns from falling into the hands of someone like this.
I know you got to run. You're high on demand. Chris Swecker, thanks so much. Appreciate your analysis.
Thank you.
All right. We're following this school shooting at Annunciation Catholic School. It's been in existence in Minneapolis since 1923. A church is just down the block from the school. It's grammar school up until eighth grade. So we think between 10 and 15 have been hurt. It seems five kids are being hospitalized at a children's hospital nearby. We'll follow the latest and take your calls about what's on your mind, and not just about this. You listen to Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
This is Jason Chaffetz from the Jason in the House podcast. Join me every Monday to dive deeper into the latest political headlines and chat with remarkable guests.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com
or wherever you download podcasts.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I am not against having the number of law enforcement officers we needed. That means police officers. That means working with local communities with police officers. Wait. With police officers. This is what Bill Bratton said to me. Wait, real simple thing, Sean. Bill Bratton said to me. Bill Bratton said to me, the way to create safety is by bringing police and community together in common cause.
Okay, you're not.
You can't do that with the military. You cannot do that with the military.
You're supporting a guy that said defund the police.
Again, wait till he gets to office. If he does, and I think
he's going to change when he gets to office.
I think he will be very clear about keeping people safe. I really do.
He's just full of crap. For Mayor de Blasio, that's a kiss of death for him to think Mamdani is the future. He's got terrible judgment. He's got terrible policies. He ruined a great city. And now these idiots the 450,000 idiots who voted for Mamdani in the primary, it's up to the other 7.5 million in the city that can vote to stand up and vote and make sure this guy doesn't get close to Gracie Mansion. And I bring this up not for a New York story. This is a national story. This 33-year-old has got young people in his camp that are around the country, and 53% of all the money is coming from outside New York. So this is going to be your problem, too. Curtis Sliwa, if he serves, he understands the city. Eric Adams understands the city, but he hires terrible people. Patrick, let's go to Sandra in New Jersey. Hey, Sandra.
Good almost afternoon, Brian. You know, Brian, I was thinking about buyer's remorse. People should look at California, what happened there. The city failed, the state failed because of poor leadership. And it's going to happen again in New York and even in New Jersey if you pick the wrong person, and you know who I mean, Mamdani. So it's very easy to destroy a city or a state, but it's very, very hard to fix it once it's destroyed. And I want people to realize you're going to regret your vote if you pick the wrong person. Look at California as an example. The floods, the fires, the people sleeping in the street, everything. So buyer beware. That's what I wanted to say.
And
Brian,
by the way, thanks for the call. By the way, they did have a chance to elect a businessman. And instead, they elected Karen Bass, who was going to Ghana, even though she knew an emergency was about to hit her city, who thinks they got a crackdown on ICE, not crackdown on crime. Patrick on Long Island. Hey, Patrick.
Hey, how you doing, Brian? Listen, I work for the New York Public Schools, and I know there was talk back in the day that the maybe possibly arming the teachers, and I really don't think the UFT would really go for that. My thought is I work for the custodial crew. I really think if they're willing and able and stuff like that to train and arm the custodial engineers, because two reasons. One, our office is right near the main entrance 90% of the times. Two, we know the building better than anyone else. So if there's an active shooter, which we've been trained on is like shutting down the building, but if there's an active shooter in the building, we know better than anyone else where to go and how to, say, come up behind them and stuff like that. But that's
a good idea. That's a great idea.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, I just got to get them trained. And the thing is, too, if I'm a teacher, I'd want a gun. I would. I would not be, I'd be responsible. I'd have it in a safe area. But when you're an active shooter, especially with third, fourth graders, they don't know where they're going. So the only thing you could do is tell them to hide.
I've been doing this for like over 30 years, and there are teachers that are willing and able to do it, but majority of UFT probably not. But I know there's a lot of custodian engineers that are willing to do it. Again, we're right there in the front, right near the main entrance.
But Patrick, as you heard with Chris Wecker, they're not. A lot of these shooters are not courageous people. They don't want to get shot back at. So if the word goes out that these schools are armed, let's say everybody in your city is armed, and they're not going to know how many or who or what type of gun they have, but they go, I'm not going to hit that school because I'm going to walk into and I'm going to get shot. Like, that would not accomplish their goal. They don't want hard targets. And even the thought that these teachers would have an option of having a gun might be able to stop the next shooter. Fred in Jacksonville. Hey, Fred, let's lighten it up a little.
Hey, Brian, how you doing? Hey, big fan, Brian. I really appreciate what you do. So it was kind of funny. I saw the whole Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce engaged and all that. And I just thought it was real funny that she marries a man, but yet she votes for Tampon Tim. I just don't understand.
But I got to give Trump credit. I got to give Trump credit, Fred, for not going after Taylor Swift. Say, best of luck. Very talented. Have fun. I love that he did that because, I don't know why she got involved in politics, all types of pressure. She also wanted to go after Senator Blackburn, remember? It didn't work. People want to hear her music. They don't care how she votes. And I hope she learned that lesson. Don't be Barbara Streisand. Every time I see Barbara Streisand, I don't think of Funny Girl. I think of Clueless Girl. So that these people be of Jane Fonda, evidently a great actress. No one thinks about that. They see a woman with a hard hat in North Vietnam. So I hope that Taylor Swift says, yeah, keep politics away. Plus, it's not like she cares. She's not talking about politics. She's been forced into it. Thanks, Fred. Lance in Galloway, New Jersey. Lance.
Hey, gracious, good morning, Brian. Just calling in after listening to Harry Hurley, your pal and mine.
He's the best.
And I just think the guy, Mondavi, he's a slick oil, slick medicine man. And he's got the same habits and charisma as when AOC first started out. He wants to give away as much as he can for free so he can bring in the sheep, wipe them down with mint jelly, and then devour them, and throw the bones to whoever's else, the working class people that are in New York trying to survive. And the thing is, I never knew so many people were apparently related to Blanche DuBois, relying on the kindness of total strangers. Thanks, Brian.
Go get him, Lance. I appreciate it. Just a quick note. I'm going to be on the 5 today. It's going to be a great show, so check that out. Also, History, Liberty, and Laughs. It went so well in Dallas. Thanks to everybody who came out. We're going to do it again in Richmond, Virginia, September 27th at the Carpenter Theater. WRVA listeners, hopefully you'll be there in mass. WLNI, too. It's only an hour away. Dominion Energy Center. Just go to BrianKilmeade.com. VIP tickets are available. The meet and greet will be at 5 o'clock, and then it'll be streamed on Fox Nation if you can't get there in person. Also, we added another show. It's Pottstown, Pennsylvania. This is the fastest we have sold tickets to date. Soul Joe's at Sunnybrook. Now, Jimmy Fallon told me it's a fantastic venue, and I hope to see you in person. And we can go to BrianKilmeade.com and get VIP tickets there. That's an early show. That's a 5 o'clock show. So I'll be driving in there and driving out the same night, and that means we'll have VIP probably around 3 o'clock. So that is November 1st. You got some time on that, but don't wait. Go to BrianKilmeade.com. Hope to see you all in person. See you on the 5 tonight. And don't forget One Nation Sundays at 10. And keep it here for all your breaking news and analysis. You just can't find anywhere else. Search around. You'll see I'm right.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.